You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported,
community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting for WFHB, this is Cade Young.
And I'm Noelle Herhusky-Schneider. This is the WFHB local news for Wednesday, March 13th, 2024.
Later in the program, WFHB correspondent Kelsey Peace interviewed executive director and a volunteer from People and Animal Learning Services about the nonprofit's mission to preserve the beneficial connection between humans and horses. More in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, deep fake danger on Better Beware, your weekly consumer watchdog segment on WFHB Local News. More following today's feature. But first, your local headlines.
On March 12th at the Bloomington Board of Public Works meeting, the board heard a contract with Fire Services Incorporated for the purchase of an aerial apparatus. Deputy Fire Chief Max Litwin explained the intended purpose of the contract.
This is a 100-foot aerial truck that will be put into frontline service to protect Bloomington. We have one in reserve that is approaching not being serviceable anymore, so this will allow us to take one of our frontline rigs, put it into reserve, and have a new one to service as a new frontline rig.
Board President Kyla Cox-Deckard walked through some background information on the agenda item.
We discussed this quite a bit in the work session yesterday, understood that this was an item that we had put in a request for, but still had some paperwork and some budgetary functions to take care of. So the vendor put us on hold, said they couldn't fulfill it at this time. Ultimately, it became available again to the city of Bloomington. So this is our opportunity to secure this important piece of equipment.
The board approved the contract unanimously. City Corporation Counsel Margie Rice asked the board to approve a contract with Action Target for $200,000 to update the police shooting range facility.
This shooting range, which is actually called the Bloomington Public Safety Training Center, at 3230 South Walnut Street was built in 2008. It's in need of some upgrades from the company that originally put it in place, which is Action Target. And the upgrades are going to total a little over $200,000. It is a sole source contract because this is proprietary equipment that will be updated by that same company. And that sole source was approved last year by the controller. And they actually scheduled and did most of the upfront work last year on this. And because this company schedules way in advance, we didn't do the contract until it got a little closer. So here we are. And happy to answer any questions you might have. We also have a representative from BPD here if you'd like to hear the exciting details about what's going to be put in place.
Cox-Deckard asked if the money was in the 2024 budget. Rice explained that the money is in the budget and has been earmarked for this contract.
So this is an item that is budgeted for in this budget for 2024?
Yes, yeah, public safety lit money. When I talked to Julie Martindale in the controller's office, she said there was about $614,000 in there, and they had kind of earmarked this $203,000 to come out of that. And I thought you asked a great question yesterday at the work session, which is, does this have anything to do with Showers West? And the answer is no. This is a completely different facility. No changes other than, maintenance and upgrades were planned.
Cox-Deckard clarified that they discussed the facility and is not involved in the Showers West police headquarters relocation debate.
Yesterday, we had a just a brief conversation about the fact that we've discussed BPD facilities quite a bit in the last several months, and that this particular property, there wasn't any intention of that property changing its use or, occupancy as far as what it's being used for, and that the updates to future plans also don't include changes to this property, that the property is staying the same.
This is planning on just staying in place. It's worked very well for them. I could be wrong about this, but I think even other agencies may use it. Is that right?
That is correct.
Yeah, it's really kind of a good collaboration for public safety in our region.
The board voted to approve the contract by a unanimous vote. The next Bloomington Board of Public Works meeting will be held on March 26th.
In today's feature report, WFHB correspondent Kelsey Peace interviewed the staff from the People and Animal Learning Services, also known as PALS, about the nonprofit's mission to preserve the beneficial connection between humans and horses. For more, we turn to Kelsey Peace. The connection between humans and horses is ancestral, yet for most, the role in our everyday lives has diminished. One nonprofit is preserving the symbiotic relationship between humans and horses through equine-assisted therapy. People and Animal Learning Services, also known as PALS, is a nonprofit adaptive riding center in Bloomington that offers therapeutic riding sessions to individuals of any age in need of physical, mental, emotional, or developmental assistance. Volunteer and treasurer Lori Miller moved to Bloomington 3 years ago, bringing with her years of experience with horses and people with disabilities. Soon after her move, she began volunteering at PALS, a place that seamlessly combined both things. Miller explained how horse therapy compares to other forms of therapy in treating patients.
I think it's interesting. In one way, horses do not judge. Horses just give you what you present to them and mirror it back to you. And I have worked with clients here who, you know, maybe it's a kid who's been bullied in school or something like that, and they think that somebody's going to judge the way they look or their clothes or their whatever. And the message here is horse doesn't care. The horse takes you as you are. And so we have seen people open up to our horses in ways that they don't with humans. We've seen kids with disabilities speak more than their parents report that they've ever spoken. We have had a couple people with Alzheimer's come, and there's something about that interaction with the horse that taps into them, and they come back for that few minutes or a little glimpse or something. There's something about the energy of the horses that is really different than when you're working with a human therapist.
Executive Director Chris Herring discovered PALS after she was in a riding accident that nearly ended her bond with horses. Even after years of riding and training them, she considered walking away. Herring discussed how PALS impacted her relationship with horses.
Most of my life, I've ridden horses. I've had my own farm, training, all of that. I was focused on what I could achieve. You know, I love the horses, but it was for my goals. And what I really realized is that by ensuring that I'm doing this for other people, that is the most satisfying thing. That's really become my purpose in life, is to be sure that people can make that connection. Before I had a pretty bad riding accident and I lost my confidence, I was ready to walk away from horses, and I had this opportunity to come to PALS and the opportunity to become the executive director that really shifted my focus and purpose with horses.
Herring further explained the historic connection between humans and horses.
We're really disconnected from the natural world these days. So when you can come to a barn and you can connect with an animal that is as big and beautiful as a horse, it's a very unique and impactful experience. Humans have always been fascinated with horses. It's their size. It's their beauty. When I think back about personally, when I first saw a horse, it's this incredible desire to want that animal to come and connect with me. And I think people throughout history have really sought that connection. I do think horses love connecting with people in general. They get, they're social creatures just like we are. They're family oriented just like we are. And they actually really seek to connect with us. So they do enjoy that connection.
Like humans, horses can experience burnout too. Herring discussed what steps PALS takes when this happens.
They are very much individuals like we are. Some horses come to the program and love this work and want to continue doing it. We watch them carefully because they can start to show signs of burnout that they're no longer interested. And we honor that. So if a horse becomes bored with the work, we start to look for other horses, and we make sure that a horse that isn't a good fit for the program is moved on to a loving family with, you know, a very good situation. It's a perfect fit for them.
Miller explains how working at PALS impacts volunteers.
This place, you can give to others, and it will also give back to you. Just being able to see our clients make new strides in something they're trying to accomplish, whether that's a physical thing or gaining confidence, feeling like they have more control over life. And then you watch the stories and it just fills your cup. And so it ends up really having an effect on you too.
You can visit PALStherapy.com for more information about becoming a volunteer or participant at PALS. For WFHB News, I'm Kelsey Peace.
Up next, hosts of WFHB's public affairs program, Bring It On, Clarence Boone and Gloria Howell, speak with investigative journalist Sandra Chapman about her book, The Girl in the Yellow Scarf. The book looks into the 1968 murder of Carol Jenkins in Martinsville, Indiana. For more, we turn to that segment.
Good evening. I'm Bring It On contributor Gloria Howell. McKenna Cardona of the IU Media School shared the following about tonight's special guest. Early in her career in journalism, investigative reporter, author, and documentarian Sandra Chapman was told to stay away from Martinsville, Indiana. It wasn't until Chapman began to research the town's history that she found the story of Carol Jenkins, to whom she would dedicate over 20 years of her career.
Cardona continues with, on September 16, 1968, 21-year-old Black woman Carol Jenkins left home for a day of selling encyclopedias in Martinsville. That evening, she was stabbed and killed while on her way back home. While the police were called, Jenkins' case was left unsolved for 3 decades. These events were the catalyst for Martinsville's reputation as a sundown town. And sundown towns, as defined, are typically described as all-white communities that exclude Black people or other minorities using discriminatory laws, harassment, or violence.
This reputation eventually reached Chapman in the form of a warning, but she sought an explanation. Chapman saw Jenkins' story and knew it had to be investigated. At the time, she was working at Wish TV in Indianapolis, and she fought for the right to cover it. In 2001, a series of Chapman's reports on the story aired, and a few days later, Chapman received a voice message that she would never forget. It came from a woman claiming to have witnessed Jenkins' murder.
And joining us this evening to share the riveting account surrounding the murder and her investigative efforts that helped resolve one of Indiana's most notorious cold cases is investigative journalist Sandra Chapman, author of The Girl in the Yellow Scarf and president of the Prince Media Group. Ms. Chapman, welcome to Bring It On.
Thank you so much. It's really my pleasure to be able to join you all this evening and to talk about this very important story.
And I tell you, my hat goes off to you. You have helped to solve one of Indiana's black eyes. This story has plagued Southern Indiana and Martinsville in particular. And one of the questions that I have after your research and your study and your deep, in-depth analysis of everything, do you think that Martinsville was unjustly labeled?
Absolutely not. Part of this is that, yes, Carol's case actually solidified a reputation that had already been in place. And actually, I think it just brought more attention to it. The fact had been that even prior to Carol's death in 1968, Martinsville was known as a racist community among athletes, mostly, who would have to come into town to play, or Martinsville's team would go to their particular venues and play football or basketball or whatever it was. And from all of the reports and the folks that we have been able to speak with who were around before 1968, they confirmed that there was definitely a stigma, and athletes talk about how different that venue was from any of the others, many of the others that they would go to play, and the things that would happen to them, the taunting, the jeers, the use of the N-word pretty regularly. And so it's not that Martinsville didn't have this reputation prior to Carol's death, but once Carol's death happened, most African Americans in Central Indiana believed that it was a racial killing right from the beginning. But Martinsville did not want to accept that. And so as the investigation went on and there was no information or very little information, and of course it didn't get solved for 33 years, Carol's death became more prominent and became a focal point of why people believed that city was not safe for African Americans.
One follow up, and then I'm going to yield to Gloria, who's on the line. Also on the line is one of our assistant producers, Liz Mitchell, who has produced Dark Past, Bright Future. And Liz and I, we collaborated on an interview about sundown towns. And Martinsville apparently now is fitting that profile very accurately. And we just recently, several weeks ago, re-aired that segment on Bring It On. But my follow-up to all this is, you mentioned that this had attained nationwide scrutiny. And when anything gets in Jet Magazine, it's for our community, it's nationwide. And I recall that, and Emmett Till and other stories that have unfortunately made the Jet Magazine and even Ebony Magazine circulations. But this sort of solidified the fact that in Southern Indiana, there were problems and issues. It made recruiting difficult for the athletes at Indiana University. It just made, really, there was this heavy cloud. And do you think they slow walked the investigation? Is it your feeling that the detective slow walked this whole thing?
It's very complicated, but basically what we found was that they did not do an adequate job of investigating. There was, when it initially happened, I think everybody was stunned and everybody was surprised because, Martinsville didn't have many murders in its town. And but yet I think what happened, what I could see, was that there were a couple of theories that they wanted to go with, popular police theories, but these theories, there was nothing in Carol's case that would back any of these things up. And they just closed their minds to the fact that she was killed because of the color of her skin. And no one really wanted to accept that. And we have articles, and, when people come out to see the documentary, we have those articles and pulled those up to show what the investigators were actually saying during that time. And honestly, they said race was the least likely motive, the least likely. And they were just not willing to take that on and take it seriously. And then as the investigations wore on, there just wasn't the type of crossing T's and dotting I's that should be in any police investigation and any investigation. You know, you've got to do the work. You've got to make sure that you are crisscrossing and making sure things line up and that they fit. And those steps just did not happen. Now, part of it was it partly because we were in central Indiana and we had, state police actually took over the investigation, but, you know, were they very skilled in dealing with these kinds of investigations? We don't know. That could be a part of it. But there does seem to be and suggest from the investigation, though, from what I just explained, that there was just an approach to this case that they didn't want to look at. And when you're investigating, you've got to open up everything. You've got to look at all the potential angles there. And even with people saying this was a race-related killing, you know, you can't close yourself off and say, no, that just can't be possible. And so I think that's more of what it was than anything.
Stay tuned next Monday at 6 p.m. to hear the full episode of Bring It On, WFHB's Black Affairs program.
Up next, Deep Fake Danger on Better Beware, your weekly consumer watchdog segment on the WFHB local news. We turn to host and producer Richard Fish for more.
Welcome to Better Beware. Here's your consumer watchdog from WFHB Community Radio with the latest information and helpful hints designed to keep your head out of the clouds, your feet on the ground, and your money in your pocket.
There's an old saying that goes way, way back, seeing is believing. But today, not so much, not anymore. There's something called deepfakes that today are becoming more dangerous than anything we've ever seen, because now almost anyone can create them. Creating fake images is nothing new. People were phonying up photographs 100 years ago, but optical trickery can be spotted pretty easily. Today, programs like Photoshop or GIMP can do all kinds of things to still images, and using them isn't all that hard. And, of course, just think how many movies use computer-generated imaging today. Movies like Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter can show you impossible things that look absolutely real. But now, the process of creating images no longer takes a big movie studio, thanks to the blessings of artificial intelligence. It's an explosion. Just 2 years ago, creating a recording of some famous person's voice saying whatever you like cost maybe $10,000 in computer processing services. Today, with a single still picture of that famous person and a few seconds of their recorded voice, it's possible to create a video of them saying anything for just a few dollars. Especially in an election year, we can expect to see more and more deepfakes, some of them a lot more dangerous than your favorite celebrity appearing to endorse some product. It could even be your face and your voice saying something you would never, ever even think of saying. So how can you spot a deepfake? It's getting harder to do, but it's not impossible if you study the image closely. Reflections of light sources in people's eyes or glasses may not match the light you're seeing. Shadows may be going one way and the light another. Then there are hands and ears. AI programs have more problems with hands and ears than anywhere else. If they look awkward or out of proportion, be suspicious. Sometimes there can even be too many fingers. You can do a reverse image search. Google has such a feature, and there are others. Do a search online for the words reverse image search, and you'll find them. Another good thing to keep an eye on is the source of the image or video. A reverse image search can help you find out where it came from. Is it a business, a political group, or an individual? Reputable sources like major newspapers, websites, and networks are becoming very careful about putting up manipulated images. If the source is someone who has an agenda or something to gain, watch out. Go online and do some research on deepfakes. There's a lot of good information available, and there are starting to be computer programs that can spot the phonies. But AI programs are getting so good so fast that any advice I can give is likely to change real soon. I'm Richard Fish for WFHB News and Public Affairs.
Better Beware comes to you from WFHB Bloomington, Indiana. Find all our episodes at wfhb.org. If you can help put the kibosh on a con, email beware@wfhb.org. Remember, swindlers never give a sucker an even break.
Support for the WFHB local news is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar-powered generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. More information online at mpisolarenergy.com. You've been listening to the WFHB local news. Today's headlines were written by Cade Young and Noelle Herhusky-Schneider in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Kelsey Peace.
Bring It On is produced by Clarence Boone. Better Beware is produced by Richard Fish. Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Engineer and executive producer is Cade Young. For WFHB, I'm Noelle Herhusky-Schneider.
And I'm Cade Young. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast online at wfhb.org.
WFHB Local News is also available as a podcast. Just search our call letters, WFHB, wherever you listen to your podcasts. Subscribe to never miss another local news program.
Stay tuned for Hereabouts, Asian American Midwest Radio, coming up next on WFHB. Listening to the WFHB local news on WFHB Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a WFHB local news volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. Feel free to check out the WFHB local news archive at wfhb.org to find newscasts, individual stories, and catch a live feed of the WFHB local news. We are local, longer,